Although we feel we are free, in reality, we, like the politicians, have become the slaves of our own desires. We have forgotten that we can be more than that, that there are other sides to human nature.
Fundamentally, here we have two different views of human nature and of democracy. You have the view that people are irrational, that they are bundles of unconscious emotion. That comes directly out of Freud. And businesses are very able to respond to that. That's what they have honed their skills doing. That's what marketing is really all about. What are the symbols, the music, the images, the words that will appeal to these unconscious feelings? Politics must be more than that. Politics and leadership are about engaging the public in a rational discussion and deliberation about what is best, and treating people with respect in terms of their rational abilities to debate what is best. If it's not that, if it is Freudian, if it is basically a matter of appealing to the same basic unconscious feelings that business appeals to, then why not let business do it? Business can do it better. Business knows how to do it. Business, after all, is in the business of responding to those feelings.
You've been listening to The Century of Self, Part 4, Eight People Sipping Wine in Kettering, a video documentary by Adam Curtis, adapted for radio. The Century of Self was produced in 2002. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica.us, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren.
I'm just driving down this highway, past a shopping mall. I see billboard after billboard, hear the advertisers call. I see cars and I hear cars and I smell cars all just like mine. I see a world covered with asphalt, you're in parking lot G9. Just sprawling on forever, doesn't even have a name. It's a land where everything looks the same. See the signs rise high above us, flashing day and night. Verizon Wireless, Holiday Inn, Coca-Cola Light. There once was grass here, maybe forest, but none of that's here now. It's just product after product, as much as time and space allow. My in Tennessee or Texas, Baltimore or Burlingame, I'm where everything looks the same. Ancient forests, family farmers, or the commons, heart of town. Does it make money? That's the question. If it don't, we'll knock it down. There's not a bicycle for miles, not a soul in sight that can't be seen behind a wheel, a few feet from the headlights. I don't know my neighbors, and I feel ashamed. Here where everything looks the same. If you don't like the Walmart, take these drugs, you'll feel okay. Now go sit behind the register and pass your life away. Eat these burgers from the factory, and if you should get fat, just give us some more money, and we've got some drugs for that. In this nation of individuals, is there one that we can blame? Why everything looks the same.
Last week in our reading of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, we learned how the first program of mass education in America was based on a method imported from India, which had originally been designed to indoctrinate the lower castes in the Hindu caste system to submit to their degrading social roles. Gatto contrasted this with the early education of some famous American historical figures who accomplished great things with little to no formal schooling. We begin this week with the last of his examples, the life of George Washington. A good yardstick to measure how far modern schooling has migrated from the education of the past is George Washington's upbringing in the middle 18th century. Although Washington descended from important families, his situation wasn't quite the easeful life that suggests. The death of his father left him at 11 without Ben Franklin's best rudder, and the practice of primogeniture, which vested virtually the entire inheritance in the first son in order to stabilize social class, compelled Washington to either face the future as a ward of his brother, an unthinkable alternative for George, or take destiny into his own hands as a boy. You probably already know how that story turned out, but since the course he pursued was nearly schoolless, its curriculum is worth a closer look. For the next few minutes, imagine yourself at school with Washington. George Washington was no genius. We know that from too many of his contemporaries to quibble. John Adams called him too illiterate, too unlearned, too unread for his station and reputation, close quote. Jefferson, his fellow Virginian, declared he liked to spend time, quote, chiefly in action, reading little. It was an age when everyone in Boston, even shoeblacks, knew how to read and count. It was a time when a working-class boy in a family of 13 like Franklin couldn't remember when he didn't know how to read. As a teenager, Washington loved two things, dancing and horseback riding. He pursued both with a passion that paid off handsomely when he became president. Large in physical stature, his appearance might have stigmatized him as awkward. Instead, by developing the agile strength of a dancer and an equestrian, he was able to communicate grace through his commanding presence, elan that counterpoised his large build at any gathering. Thanks to his twin obsessions, he met his responsibilities with the bearing of a champion athlete, which saved his life during the Revolution. In the midst of the fray, a British sharpshooter drew a bead on his target, but found himself unable to pull the trigger because Washington bore himself so magnificently. George Mercer, a friend, described Washington as a young man in the following way, quote, "He is straight as an Indian, measuring 6 feet 2 inches in his stockings and weighing 175 pounds. His frame is padded with well-developed muscles, indicating great strength. British military superiority, including the best available war-making technology, would have made hash of a brainless commander in spite of his admirable carriage, so we need to analyze the curriculum which produced America's Fabius, as he was called." Washington had no schooling until he was 11, no classroom confinement, no blackboards. He arrived at school already knowing how to read, write, and calculate about as well as the average college student today. If that sounds outlandish, turn back to Franklin's curriculum and compare it with the intellectual diet of a modern, gifted, and talented class. Full literacy wasn't unusual in the colonies or early republic. Many schools wouldn't admit students who didn't know reading and counting because few schoolmasters were willing to take the time teaching what was so easy to learn. It was deemed a mark of depraved character if literacy hadn't been attained by the matriculating student. Even the many charity schools operated by churches, towns, and philanthropic associations for the poor would have been flabbergasted at the great hue and cry raised today about difficulties teaching literacy. American experience proved the contrary. In New England and the Middle Atlantic colonies, where reading was especially valued, literacy was universal. The printed word was also valued in the South, where literacy was common, if not universal. In fact, it was general literacy among all classes that spurred the explosive growth of colleges in 19th century America, where even ordinary folks hungered for advanced forms of learning. Following George to school at 11 to see what the schoolmaster had in store would reveal a skimpy menu of studies, yet one with a curious gravity: geometry, trigonometry, and surveying. You might regard that as impossible, or consider it was only a dumbed-down version of those things. Some kid's game, akin to the many simulations one finds today in schools for prosperous children. Simulated city building, simulated court trials, simulated businesses, virtual realities to bridge the gap between adult society and the immaturity of the young. But if George didn't get the real thing, how do you account for his first job as official surveyor for Culpeper County, Virginia, only 2,000 days after he first hefted a surveyor's transit in school? For the next 3 years, Washington earned the equivalent of about $100,000 a year in today's purchasing power. It is probable his social connections helped this fatherless boy get the position. But in frontier society, anyone would be crazy to give a boy serious work unless he actually could do it. Almost at once, he began speculating in land. He didn't need a futurist to tell him which way the historical wind was blowing. By the age of 21, he had leveraged his knowledge and income into 2,500 acres of prime land in Frederick County, Virginia. Washington had no father as a teenager, and we know he was no genius, yet he learned geometry, trigonometry, and surveying when he would have been a fifth or sixth grader in our era. 10 years later, he had prospered directly by his knowledge. His entire life was a work of art in the sense that it was an artifice under his control. He eventually freed his slaves without being coerced to do so. Washington could easily have been the first king in America. But he discouraged any thinking on that score, and despite many critics, he was so universally admired, the seat of government was named after him while he was still alive. Washington attended school for exactly 2 years. Besides the subjects mentioned, at 12 and 13 and later, he studied frequently used legal forms like bills of exchange, tobacco receipts, leases, and patents. From these forms, he was asked to deduce the theory, philosophy, and custom which produced them. By all accounts, this steeping in grown-up reality didn't bore him at all. I had the same experience with Harlem kids 250 years later. Following a similar procedure in teaching them how to struggle with complex income tax forms, young people learn for this kind of guided introduction to serious things, I think. When that yearning is denied, schooling destroys their belief that justice governs human affairs. By his own choice, Washington put time into learning deportment, how to be regarded as a gentleman by other gentlemen. He copied a book of rules which had been used at Jesuit schools for over a century, and with that, his observations and what advice he could secure gathered his own character. Here's Rule 56 to let you see the flavor of the thing. Quote, "Associate yourself with men of good quality if you esteem your own reputation." Close quote. Sharp kid. No wonder he became president. Washington also studied geography and astronomy on his own, gaining a knowledge of regions, continents, oceans, and heavens. In light of the casual judgment of his contemporaries that his intellect was of normal proportions, you might be surprised to hear that by 18 he had devoured all the writings of Henry Fielding, Tobias Smollett, and Daniel Defoe, and read regularly the famous and elegant Spectator. He also read Seneca's Morals, Julius Caesar's Commentaries, and the major writing of other Roman generals like the historian Tacitus. At 16, the future president began writing memos to himself about clothing design, not content to allow something so important to be left in the hands of tradesmen. Years later, he became his own architect for the magnificent estate of Mount Vernon. While still in his 20s, he began to experiment with domestic industry where he might avoid the vagaries of international finance in things like cotton or tobacco. First, he tried to grow hemp for medicinal purposes, which didn't work out. Next, he tried flax. That didn't work either. At the age of 31, he hit on wheat. In 7 years, he had a little wheat business with his own flour mills and hired agents to market his brand of flour. A little later, he built fishing boats. 4 years before the declaration was written, he was pulling in 9 million herring a year. No public school in the United States is set up to allow a George Washington to happen. Washingtons in the bud stage are screened, browbeaten, or bribed to conform to a narrow outlook on social truth. Boys like Andrew Carnegie, who begged his mother not to send him to school and was well on his way to immortality and fortune at the age of 13, would be referred today for psychological counseling. Thomas Edison would find himself in special ed until his peculiar genius had been sufficiently tamed. Anyone who reads can compare what the American present does in isolating children from their natural sources of education, modeling them on a niggardly last, to what the American past proved about human capabilities. The effect of the forced schooling institution's strange accomplishment has been monumental. No wonder history has been outlawed. And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. As we move towards the conclusion of Chapter 1, The Way It Used to Be, with Montaigne's Curriculum. Between the fall of Rome in the late 5th century and the decline of monarchy in the 18th, secular schooling in any form was hardly a ripple on the societies of Europe. There was talk of it at certain times and places, but it was courtly talk, never very serious. What simple schooling we find was mostly undertaken by religious orders, which usually had no greater ambition than providing a stream of assistance to the ecclesiastical bureaucracy, and perhaps molding the values of whatever future leaders proved susceptible. The few exceptions shouldn't be looked upon as the spark for our own schools. School was only a tiny blip on the radar until the last half of the 18th century. If you and I are to have a productive partnership in this book, you need to clear your mind of false history, the type that clogs the typical school chronicle written for teacher training institutes, where each fact may be verifiable, but the conclusions drawn from them are not. Turn to typical school history, and you will learn about the alleged anticipation of our own schools by Comenius, of the reformed Latin grammar school founded by Dean Colley at St. Paul's in London in 1510, of the solitaries of Port Royal, whoever these lonely men may have been. Each instance is real. The direction they lead in is false. What formal school experimentation in the West provided touched only a tiny fraction of the population, and rarely those who became social leaders, let alone pioneers of the future. You can disinter proclamations about schooling from Alfred's kingdom or Charlemagne's, but you can't find a scrap of hard evidence that the thing was ever seriously essayed. What talk of schooling occurs is the exclusive property of philosophers, secret societies, and a host of cranks, quacks, and schemers. What you never find anywhere is any popular clamor for a place to dump children called school. Yet while schooling is conspicuous by its absence, there's no shortage of intelligent commentary about education, a commodity not to be conflated with the lesser term until late in history. Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini, Pope Pius II, in his tract The Education of Children, 1451, prescribes the reading and study of classical authors, geometry, and arithmetic for training the mind and assuring rapidity of conceptions. He included history and geography in his recommended curriculum, adding that there is nothing in the world more beautiful than enlightened intelligence, close quote. The 16th century is filled with theories of education from men like Erasmus, Rabelais, and Montaigne. French schoolman Gabriel Compère, in his History of Pedagogy, 1885, holds all three in the highest regard. Quote, Erasmus, Rabelais, and Montaigne, before pretending to surpass them even at this day, we should rather attempt to overtake them and to equal them in their pedagogical precepts. Like most men and women, Erasmus was his own teacher. He assigned politeness an important place in education. Quote, the tender mind of the child should love and learn the liberal arts, be taught tact in the conduct of the social life. from the earliest be accustomed to good behavior based on moral principles. Close quote. Montaigne, who actually attended school at Guienne from the age of 6 until he was 13, bequeathed an image of late 16th century schooling amazingly modern in its particulars. Quote, "'Tis the true house of correction of imprisoned youth. Do but come when they are about their lesson, and you shall hear nothing but the outcries of boys under execution, with the thundering noise of their pedagogues, drunk with fury, to make up the consort. A pretty way to tempt these tender and timorous souls to love their book, with a furious countenance and a rod in hand." Close quote. What Montaigne requires of a student seeking education is the development of sound judgment. Quote, "If the judgment be not better settled, I would rather have him spend his time at tennis." Close quote. Montaigne was preoccupied with the training of judgment. He would have history learned, so the facts have context and historical judgment a bearing on contemporary affairs. He was intrigued by the possibilities of emulation, as were all the classical masters, and so informs us. He said we need to see the difference between teaching where Marcellus died, which is unimportant, and teaching why it was unworthy of his duty that he died there, which has great significance. For Montaigne, learning to judge well and speak well is where education resides. Quote, "Whatever presents itself to our eyes serves as a sufficient book. The knavery of a page, the blunder of a servant, a table witticism, conversation with men is wonderfully helpful. So is a visit to foreign lands, to whet and sharpen our wits by rubbing them upon those of others." And in Gargantua, the physician Rabelais set out a pedagogy quite in harmony with the experience-based curriculum of John Locke. When I started teaching, I was able to transfer principles of Montaigne to my classroom without any difficulty. They proved as useful to me in 1962 as they must have been to Montaigne in 1562. Wisdom, eternally sane, always cost-free. In contrast, the bloated lists of aims, motivations, and methods the New York City Board of Education supplied me with were worse than useless. Many were dead wrong. One important bit of evidence that the informal attitude toward schooling was beginning to break up in 17th century New England is found in the Massachusetts School Law of 1647, legislation attempting to establish a system of schools by government and providing means to enforce that order. Talk like this had been around for centuries, but this was a significant enactment, coming from a theocratic utopia on the frontier of the known universe. Yet for all the effort of New England Puritan leadership to make its citizenry uniform through schooling and pulpit, one of history's grand ironies is that orderly Anglican Virginia and the heirs of Puritan Massachusetts were the prime makers of a revolution which successfully overthrew the regulated uniformity of Britain. And neither in the startling Declaration of Independence, which set out the motives for this revolution, nor in the even more startling Bill of Rights, in which ordinary people claim their reward for courageous service, is either the word school or the word education even mentioned. At the nation's founding, nobody thought school a cause worth going to war for. Nobody thought it a right worth claiming. And that's the conclusion of Chapter 1, The Way It Used to Be, from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. John Taylor Gatto spent 30 years as a public school teacher in New York City. In his 50s, having just been named Teacher of the Year, he resigned from teaching, having become disillusioned in the whole system of schooling and its impact on the minds and lives of young people and the adults they would become.
The more shall I work in the factory, greasy up my clothes. No more shall I work in the factory, splinters in my toes. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away. No more shall I hear the bosses say, boys, you better doff. No more shall I hear the bosses say, spinners, you better clean off. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away. Or shall I hear the drummer wheels rolling over my head? When factories are hard at work, I'll be in my bed. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away. No more shall I wear the old black dress, greasy all around. No more shall I wear the old black bonnet with holes all in the crown. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away. Shall I see the super come all dressed up so proud? For I know I'll marry a country boy when the year is out. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away. Pity me, my darling, pity me, I say. Pity me, my darling, and carry me away.
Now we begin chapter 2, Lies, Dirty Lies and Damn Lies, An Angry Look at Modern Schooling. The secret of American schooling is that it doesn't teach the way children learn, and it isn't supposed to. It took 7 years of reading and reflection to finally figure out that mass schooling of the young by force was a creation of the four great coal powers of the 19th century. Nearly 100 years later, on April 11, 1933, Max Mason, president of the Rockefeller Foundation, announced to insiders that a comprehensive national program was underway to allow, in Mason's words, the control of human behavior. Today's corporate sponsors want to see their money used in ways to line up with business objectives. This is a young generation of corporate sponsors, and they have discovered the advantages of building long-term relationships with educational institutions. That quote from Susan Cornforth of Pascal & Associates, public relations consultants, as quoted in the New York Times, July 15, 1998. Sometimes the best hiding place is right in the open. It took 7 years of reading and reflection for me to finally figure out that mass schooling of the young by force was a creation of the four great coal powers of the 19th century. It was under my nose, of course, but for years I avoided seeing what was there because no one else seemed to notice. Forced schooling arose from the new logic of the industrial age, the logic imposed on flesh and blood by fossil fuel and high-speed machinery. This simple reality is hidden from view by early philosophical and theological anticipations of mass schooling in various writings about social order and human nature. But you shouldn't be fooled any more than Charles Francis Adams was fooled when he observed in 1880 that what was being cooked up for kids unlucky enough to be snared by the newly proposed institutional school net combined characteristics of the cotton mill and the railroad with those of a state prison. After the Civil War, utopian speculative analysis regarding isolation of children into custodial compounds where they could be subjected to deliberate molding routines began to be discussed seriously by the Northeastern policy elites of business, government, and university life. These discussions were inspired by a growing realization that the productive potential of machinery driven by coal was limitless. Railroad development made possible by coal and startling new inventions like the telegraph seemed suddenly to make village life and local dreams irrelevant. A new governing mind was emerging in harmony with the new reality. The principal motivation for this revolution in family and community life might seem to be greed, but this surface appearance conceals philosophical visions approaching religious exaltation and intensity. That effective early indoctrination of all children would lead to an orderly scientific society, one controlled by the best people. Now freed from the obsolete straitjacket of democratic traditions and historic American libertarian attitudes. Forced schooling was the medicine to bring the whole continental population into conformity with these plans, so it might be regarded as a human resource and managed as a workforce. No more Ben Franklin's or Tom Edison's could be allowed. They set a bad example. One way to manage this was to see to it that individuals were prevented from taking up their working lives until an advanced age when the ardor of youth and its insufferable self-confidence had cooled. From the beginning, there was purpose behind forced schooling, purpose which had nothing to do with what parents, kids, or communities wanted. Instead, this grand purpose was forged out of what a highly centralized corporate economy and system of finance, bent on internationalizing itself, was thought to need. That, and what a strong, centralized political state needed, too. School was looked upon from the first decade of the 20th century as a branch of industry and a tool of governance. For a considerable time, probably provoked by a climate of official anger and contempt directed against immigrants in the greatest displacement of people in history, social managers of schooling were remarkably candid about what they were doing. In a speech he gave before businessmen prior to the First World War, Woodrow Wilson made this unabashed disclosure, quote, "We want one class to have a liberal education. We want another class, a very much larger class of necessity, to forgo the privilege of a liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific, difficult, manual tasks." Close quote. By 1917, the major administrative jobs in American schooling were under the control of a group referred to in the press of that day as the Education Trust. The first meeting of this trust included representatives of Rockefeller, Carnegie, Harvard, Stanford, the University of Chicago, and the National Education Association. "The chief end," wrote Benjamin Kidd, the British evolutionist, in 1918, "was to impose on the young the ideal of subordination." Close quote. At first, the primary target was the tradition of independent livelihoods in America. Unless Yankee entrepreneurialism could be extinguished, at least among the common population, the immense capital investments that mass production industry required for equipment weren't conceivably justifiable. Students were to learn to think of themselves as employees competing for the favor of management, not as Franklin or Edison had once regarded themselves, as self-determined free agents. Only by a massive psychological campaign could the menace of overproduction in America be contained. That's what important men and academics called it. The ability of Americans to think as independent producers had to be curtailed. Certain writings of Alexander Inglis carry a hint of schooling's role in this ultimately successful project to curb the tendency of little people to compete with big companies. From 1880 to 1930, overproduction became a controlling metaphor among the managerial classes, and this idea would have a profound influence on the development of mass schooling. I know how difficult it is for most of us who mow our lawns and walk our dogs to comprehend that long-range social engineering even exists, let alone that it began to dominate compulsion schooling nearly a century ago. Yet, the 1934 edition of Elwood P. Cubberley's Public Education in the United States is explicit about what happened and why. As Cubberley puts it, quote, "It has come to be desirable that children should not engage in productive labor. On the contrary, all recent thinking is opposed to their doing so. Both the interests of organized labor and the interests of the nation have set against child labor." Close quote. The statement occurs in a section of public education called A New Lengthening of the Period of Dependence, in which Cubberley explains that the coming of the factory system has made extended childhood necessary by depriving children of the training and education that farm and village life once gave. With the breakdown of home and village industries, the passing of chores, and the extinction of the apprenticeship system by large-scale production with its extreme division of labor, and all the conquering march of machinery, an army of workers has arisen, said Cubberley, who know nothing. Furthermore, modern industry needs such workers. Sentimentality should not be allowed to stand in the way of progress. According to Cubberley, with, quote, "much ridicule from the public press, the old book subject curriculum was set aside, replaced by a change in purpose and a new psychology of instruction which came to us from abroad." That last mysterious reference to a new psychology is to practices of dumbed-down schooling common in England, Germany, and France, the three major world coal powers other than the United States, each of which had already converted its common population into an industrial proletariat. Arthur Calhoun's 1919 Social History of the Family notified the nation's academics what was happening. Calhoun declared that the fondest wish of utopian writers was coming true. The child was passing from its family into the custody of community experts. He offered a significant forecast that in time we could expect to see public education designed to check the mating of the unfit. 3 years later, Mayor John F. Hyland of New York said in a public speech that the schools had been seized as an octopus would seize prey by an invisible government. He was referring specifically to certain actions of the Rockefeller Foundation and other corporate interests in New York City, which preceded the school riots of 1917. The 1920s were a boom period for forced schooling, as well as for the stock market. In 1928, a well-regarded volume called A Sociological Philosophy of Education claimed, quote, "It is the business of teachers to run not merely schools, but the world." A year later, the famous creator of educational psychology, Edward Thorndike of Columbia Teachers College, announced, "Academic subjects are of little value." William Kirkpatrick, his colleague at Teachers College, boasted in Education and the Social Crisis that the whole tradition of rearing the young was being made over by experts. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, Chapter 2, An Angry Look at Modern Schooling. We continue with the Geneticists' Manifesto. Meanwhile, at the project offices of an important employer of experts, the Rockefeller Foundation, friends were hearing from Max Mason, its president, that a comprehensive national program was underway to allow, in Mason's words, the control of human behavior. This dazzling ambition was announced on April 11, 1933. Schooling figured prominently in the design. Rockefeller had been inspired by the work of Eastern European scientist Hermann Müller to invest heavily in genetics. Müller had used X-rays to override genetic law, inducing mutations in fruit flies. This seemed to open the door to the scientific control of life itself. Müller preached that planned breeding would bring mankind to paradise faster than God. His proposal received enthusiastic endorsement from the greatest scientists of the day, as well as from powerful economic interests. Müller would win the Nobel Prize. Reduce his proposal to a 1,500-word geneticist manifesto, and watch with satisfaction as 22 distinguished American and British biologists of the day signed it. The state must prepare to consciously guide human sexual selection, said Müller. School would have to separate worthwhile breeders from those slated for termination. Just a few months before this report was released, an executive director of the National Education Association announced that his organization expected to accomplish by education what dictators in Europe are seeking to do by compulsion and force, close quote. You can't get much clearer than that. World War II drove the project underground, but hardly retarded its momentum. Following cessation of global hostilities, school became a major domestic battleground for the scientific rationalization of social affairs through compulsory indoctrination. Great private corporate foundations led the way. 30-odd years later, between 1967 and 1974, teacher training in the United States was covertly revamped through coordinated efforts of a small number of private foundations, select universities, global corporations, think tanks, and government agencies, all coordinated through the U.S. Office of Education and through key state education departments like those in California, Texas, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and New York. Important milestones of the transformation were: 1. An extensive government exercise in futurology called Designing Education for the Future. 2. The Behavioral Science Teacher Education Project. And 3. Benjamin Bloom's multi-volume Taxonomy of Educational Objectives, an enormous manual of over 1,000 pages, which in time impacted every school in America. While other documents exist, these three are appropriate touchstones of the whole, serving to make clear the nature of the project underway. Take them one by one and savor each. Designing Education, produced by the Education Department, redefined the term education after the Prussian fashion as, quote, a means to achieve important economic and social goals of a national character, close quote. State education agencies would henceforth act as on-site federal enforcers, ensuring the compliance of local schools with central directives. Each state education department was assigned the task of becoming an agent of change and advised to, quote, lose its independent identity as well as its authority in order to form a partnership with the federal government. The second document, the gigantic Behavioral Science Teacher Education Project, outlined teaching reforms to be forced on the country after 1967. The document sets out clearly the intention of its creators, nothing less than impersonal manipulation through schooling of a future America in which, quote, few will be able to maintain control over their opinions. An America in which, quote, each individual receives at birth a multi-purpose identification number, which enables employers and other controllers to keep track of underlings and expose them to direct or subliminal influence when necessary. Readers learn that, quote, chemical experimentation on minors would be normal procedure in this post-1967 world. A pointed foreshadowing of the massive Ritalin interventions which now accompany the practice of forced schooling. The Behavioral Science Teacher Education Project identified the future as one, quote, in which a small elite will control all important matters, one where participatory democracy will largely disappear. Children are made to see through school experiences that their classmates are so cruel and irresponsible, so inadequate to the task of self-discipline, and so ignorant, they need to be controlled and regulated for society's good. Under such a local regime, school terror can only be regarded as good advertising. It is sobering to think of mass schooling as a vast demonstration project of human inadequacy, but that is at least one of its functions. Postmodern schooling, we are told, is to focus on, quote, pleasure cultivation and other attitudes and skills compatible with a non-work world. Thus, the socialization classroom of the century's beginning, itself a radical departure from schooling for mental and character development, can be seen to have evolved by 1967 into a full-scale laboratory for psychological experimentation. School conversion was assisted powerfully by a curious phenomenon of the middle to late 1960s. A tremendous rise in school violence and general school chaos, which followed a policy declaration, which seems to have occurred nationwide, that the disciplining of children must henceforth mimic the due process practice of the court system. Teachers and administrators were suddenly stripped of any effective ability to keep order in schools, since the due process apparatus of necessity, a slow, deliberate matter, is completely inadequate to the continual outbreaks of childish mischief all schools experience. Now, without the time-honored ad hoc armory of disciplinary tactics to fall back on, disorder spiraled out of control, passing from the realm of annoyance into the more dangerous terrain entirely as word surged through the student bodies that teacher hands were tied. And each outrageous event that reached the attention of the local press served as an advertisement for expert prescriptions. Who had ever seen kids behave this way? Time to surrender community involvement to the management of experts. Time also for emergency measures like special education and Ritalin. During this entire period, lasting 5 to 7 years, outside agencies like the Ford Foundation exercised the right to supervise whether children's rights were being given due attention, fanning the flames hotter, even long after trouble had become virtually unmanageable. The Behavioral Science Teacher Education Project, published at the peak of this violence, informed teacher training colleges that under such circumstances, teachers had to be trained as therapists. They must translate prescriptions of social psychology into, quote, practical action in the classroom. As curriculum had been redefined, so teaching followed suit. The third in the series of new gospel texts was Bloom's Taxonomy. In his own words, a tool to classify the way individuals are to act, think, or feel as the result of some unit of instruction, close quote. Using methods of behavioral psychology, children would learn proper thoughts, feelings, and actions, and have their improper attitudes brought from home remediated. In all stages of the school experiment, testing was essential to localize the child's mental state on an official rating scale. Bloom's epic spawned important descendant forms: mastery learning, outcomes-based education, and school-to-work government-business collaborations. Each classified individuals for the convenience of social managers and businesses. Each offered data useful in controlling the mind and movements of the young, mapping the next adult generation. But for what purpose? Why was this being done? And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Bad character as a management tool. A large piece of the answer can be found by reading between the lines of an article that appeared in the June 1998 issue of Foreign Affairs. Written by Mortimer Zuckerman, owner of U.S. News and World Report and other major publications, the essay praises the American economy, characterizing its lead over Europe and Asia as so structurally grounded, no nation can possibly catch up for 100 years. American workers and the American managerial system are unique. You are intrigued, I hope. So was I. Unless you believe in master race biology, our advantage can only have come from the training of the American young, in school and out, training which produces attitudes and behavior useful to management. What might these crucial determinants of business success be? First, says Zuckerman, the American worker is a pushover. That's my translation, not his. But I think it's a fair take on what he means when he says that the American is indifferent to everything but a paycheck. He doesn't try to tell the boss his job. By contrast, Europe suffers from a strong steam age craft tradition where workers demand a large voice in decision making. Asia is even worse off because even though the Asian worker is silenced, tradition and government interfere with what business can do. Next, says Zuckerman, workers in America live in constant panic. They know companies here owe them nothing as fellow human beings. Fear is our secret supercharger, giving management flexibility no other country has. In 1996, after 5 years of record profitability, almost half of all Americans in big business feared being laid off. This fear keeps a brake on wages. Next, in the United States, human beings don't make decisions. Abstract formulas do. Management by mathematical rules makes the company manager-proof as well as worker-proof. Finally, our endless consumption completes the charmed circle. Consumption driven by nonstop addiction to novelty, a habit which provides American business with the only reliable domestic market in the world. Elsewhere in hard times, business dries up, but not here. Here, we shop till we drop, mortgaging the future in bad times as well as good. Can't you feel in your bones Zuckerman is right? I have little doubt the fantastic wealth of American big business is psychologically and procedurally grounded in our form of schooling. The training field for these grotesque human qualities is the classroom. Schools train individuals to respond as a mass. Boys and girls are drilled in being bored, frightened, envious, emotionally needy, generally incomplete. A successful mass production economy requires such a clientele. A small business, small farm economy like that of the Amish requires individual competence, thoughtfulness, compassion, and universal participation. Our own requires a managed mass of leveled, spiritless, anxious, familyless, friendless, godless, obedient people who believe the difference between Cheers and Seinfeld is a subject worth arguing about. The extreme wealth of American big business is the direct result of school having trained us in certain attitudes like a craving for novelty. That's what the bells are for. They don't ring so much as to say, now for something different. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. The secret of American schooling is that it doesn't teach the way children learn, and it isn't supposed to. School was engineered to serve a concealed command economy and a deliberately restratified social order. It wasn't made for the benefit of kids and families, as those individuals and institutions would define their own needs. School is the first impression children get of organized society. Like most first impressions, it is the lasting one. Life, according to school, is dull and stupid. Only consumption promises relief. Coke, Big Macs, fashion jeans, that's where real meaning is found. That is the classroom's lesson, however indirectly delivered. The decisive dynamics which make forced schooling poisonous to healthy human development aren't hard to spot. Work in classrooms isn't significant work. It fails to satisfy real needs pressing on the individual. It doesn't answer real questions experience raises in the young mind. It doesn't contribute to solving any problem encountered in actual life. The net effect of making all schoolwork external to individual longings, experiences, questions, and problems is to render the victim listless. This phenomenon has been well understood, at least since the time of the British enclosure movement, which forced small farmers off their land into factory work. Growth and mastery come only to those who vigorously self-direct. Initiating, creating, doing, reflecting, freely associating, enjoying privacy, these are precisely what the structures of schooling are set up to prevent on one pretext or another. As I watched it happen, it took about 3 years to break most kids. 3 years confined to environments of emotional neediness with nothing real to do. In such environments, songs, smiles, bright colors, cooperative games, and other tension breakers do the work better than angry words and punishment. Years ago, it struck me as more than a little odd that the Prussian government was the patron of Heinrich Pestalozzi, inventor of multicultural fun and game psychology elementary schooling, and of Friedrich Froebel, inventor of kindergarten. It struck me as odd that J.P. Morgan's partner Peabody was instrumental in bringing Prussian schooling to the prostrate South after the Civil War. But after a while, I began to see that behind the philanthropy lurked a rational economic purpose. The strongest meshes of the school net are invisible. Constant bidding for a stranger's attention creates a chemistry producing the common characteristics of modern school children: whining, dishonesty, malice, treachery, cruelty. Unceasing competition for official favor in the dramatic fishbowl of a classroom delivers cowardly children, little people sunk in chronic boredom, little people with no apparent purpose for being alive. The full significance of the classroom as a dramatic environment, as primarily a dramatic environment, has never been properly acknowledged or examined. The most destructive dynamic is identical to that which causes caged rats to develop eccentric or even violent mannerisms when they press a bar for sustenance on an aperiodic reinforcement schedule, one where food is delivered at random but the rat doesn't suspect. Much of the weird behavior school kids display is a function of the aperiodic reinforcement schedule. And the endless confinement and inactivity slowly drive children out of their minds. Trapped children, like trapped rats, need close management. Any rat psychologist will tell you that. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. We'll continue with more of Chapter 2 next week, An Angry Look at Modern Schooling. John Taylor Gatto spent 30 years as a public school teacher in New York City, and after winning numerous awards for his teaching, was moved to resign through disillusionment with the project of compulsory schooling. If you've missed any of the previous readings of the book, you can access all of our shows through our archive at unwelcomeguest.org, and you can learn more about John Taylor Gatto's work at johntaylorgatto.com. Gatto is spelled G-A-T-T-O. Thanks to David Rovix, whose music was featured in today's program, and to Billy Bragg and Wilco, who perform our theme music, Unwelcome Guests, whose lyrics were written by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers.